Namaste. Good evening. You need some news to cheer you up? Why don't we turn to Sri Aurobindo and review something more substantial than what has been dominating headlines of late. We are working in a chapter called The Origin of the Ignorance. This is the 12th chapter in the second book of The Life Divine. We've reached a passage where Sri Aurobindo is going to recapitulate the very substance of what we're speaking about. What is the nature of reality? We've seen over these couple of years that we've been looking into this that this concept of Satchit-Ananda is absolutely critical to his philosophy. In some ways you can say it is that which unites both poles of his vast spiritual realization. Because on the one hand, he had first the experience of a Brahmic Nirvana, which seemed to block out the active world, turn it into a phantasmagorial display by comparison with that unnameable vastness that was implied in conscious being. But on the other side, he had a great experience in which all the world was revealed to be the very being of a personal divine. And in this concept of Satchit-Ananda, we find a Vedantic formulation of a theistic view. This is theistic Vedanta. And Satchit-Ananda, existence, consciousness, bliss, in this philosophy, is not an impersonal that. It is a being who is conscious of his own essence and extension, of his own power. And what rises from the interplay of consciousness as being is a field of delight. So Sri Aurobindo returns to this theme again and again in his discussions, his lucubrations, if you wish. So we are coming to it immediately tonight. We begin with a paragraph that reads, "This something is, as Vedanta insists, and as we have throughout insisted, in its manifest nature, Satchit-Ananda, a trinity of absolute existence, consciousness, and bliss." Trinity, let's remember what that means. Threefoldness, it means tri-unity. Not three things cobbled together, but three things which are one. A trinity of absolute existence, consciousness, and bliss. It is from this primal truth that we must start in approaching the problem. And it is evident then that the solution must be found in an action of consciousness manifesting itself as knowledge and yet limiting that knowledge in such a way as to create the phenomenon of ignorance. And since the ignorance is a phenomenon of the dynamic action of force of consciousness, not an essential fact, but a creation, a consequence of that action, it is this force aspect of consciousness that it will be fruitful to consider. So it is the compression of consciousness through forceful movement within the conscious field of being that results in ignorance. But it is not as primary an aspect as consciousness itself. It is something derived from the action of consciousness. To understand it, we have to look at this force aspect. And so he goes on. Absolute consciousness is in its nature absolute power. The nature of chit is shakti. Chit is the Sanskrit word for consciousness. Shakti is the Sanskrit word for power. Force, or shakti, concentrated and energized for cognition or for action in a realizing power, effective or creative, the power of conscious being dwelling upon itself and bringing out, as it were, by the heat of its incubation, the seed and development of all that is within it, or, to use a language convenient to our minds, of all its truths and potentialities, has created the universe. So, Shakti has created the universe. It extends itself through tapas in the creation. There's a footnote. We need to look at it. Tapas means literally heat. Well, tapas is a word that comes from tap, which means to heat. Tapas means literally heat. Afterwards, any kind of energism, ascesis, austerity of conscious force, acting upon itself or its object. The world was created by tapas in the form, says the ancient image, of an egg, which, being broken again by tapas, heat of incubation of conscious force, the Purusha emerged, soul in nature, like a bird from the egg. Now, these are passages that you can find in the Shatapatha Brahmana. You can also find this in the Chandogya Upanishad, I think, in the third chapter, the 19th verse, right at the beginning. Third section, 19th chapter, first verse. So this idea of the Purusha coming out of being closeted in nature. It may be observed that the usual translation of the word tapasya in English books, penance, is quite misleading. The idea of penance entered rarely into the austerities practiced by Indian ascetics. Nor was mortification of the body the essence even of the most severe and self-afflicting austerities. The aim was rather an overpassing of the hold of the bodily nature on the consciousness, or else a supernormal energizing of the consciousness and will to gain some spiritual or other object. So you undertook tapasya to gain control, to master, to break through, to achieve. He continues, if we examine our own consciousness, we shall see that this power of its energy applying itself to its object is really the most positive dynamic force it has. By that, it arrives at all its knowledge and its action and its creation. So, chit, acting through its shakti, achieves all, knowledge and everything else. The perfection of the work that it seeks to do. Everything is achieved by the energism of its consciousness. But for us, there are two objects on which the dynamism within can act: ourselves, the internal world, and others, whether creatures or things, the external world around us. To Satchit Ananda, this distinction, with its effective and operative consequences, does not apply in the same way as for us, because all is himself and within himself, and there is no such division as we make by the limitations of our mind. Secondly, in us, only a part of the force of our being is identified with our voluntary action, with our will engaged in mental or other activity. The rest is to our surface mental awareness, involuntary in its action, or subconscient or superconscient. And from this division also, a great number of important practical consequences emerge. But in Satchit Ananda, this division too and its consequences do not apply, since all is his one indivisible self, and all action and result are movements of his one indivisible will, his consciousness force, chit shakti, in dynamic operation. Tapas is the nature of action of consciousness. Let me start again. Tapas is the nature of action of his consciousness as of ours, but it is the integral tapas of an integral consciousness in an indivisible existence. So, for us, we distinguish between self and other. For us, our experience is not total. Even in our awareness, as vast as it becomes, we're not able to penetrate the subconscious beneath us. We're not able to penetrate the superconscious above. These things seem to be outside our ken, beyond our realm. We have no personal control. We do not identify with them. We relate fitfully with others, and occasionally with deeper and higher states of consciousness. But to Satchit Ananda, these divisions and these distinctions do not apply, because all occurs and dwells within that single being. It is consciousness, which is being, which is fully aware of every strata of its nature. And so then, its action is within that singly and does not get lost in the play. So it is an integral tapas, and let's remember what integral means. It comes from that Latin word integer, integer, which literally means not to touch. It can't be divided. You can't touch it and mess it up. An integer is whole. It is entire. It is unimpaired. It is intrinsic. It can't be disturbed. So an integral tapas in an integral consciousness in an indivisible existence describes the nature of Satchit Ananda. It cannot be divided. It is one and whole in consciousness and being and in the action that occurs. But here a question may arise. Since there is a passivity in existence and in nature as well as an activity, immobile status as well as kinesis, what is the place and role of this force, this power, and its concentration in regard to a status where there is no play of energy, where all is immobile. So we've been talking about activity. What about the passive nature of the divine, where it is not active? In ourselves, we habitually associate our tapas, our conscious force, with active consciousness, with energy at play, and in internal or external act and motion. That which is passive in us produces no action or only an involuntary or mechanical action, and we do not associate it with our will or conscious force. Still, since there too there is the possibility of action or the emergence of an automatic activity, it must have at least a passively responsive or automatic conscious force in it. Or there is in it either a secretly positive or a negative and inverse tapas. So chit shakti extends itself as tapas. It may also be that there is a larger conscious force, power, or will in our being unknown to us, which is behind this involuntary action. If not a will, at least a force of some kind, which itself initiates action or else responds to the contacts, suggestions, stimulations of the universal energy. In nature also, we know that things stable, inert, or passive are yet maintained in their energy by a secret and unceasing motion, an energy in action upholding the apparent immobility. Here too, then, all is due to the presence of Shakti, to the action of its power in concentration, its tapas. But beyond this relative aspect of status and kinesis, we find that we have the power to arrive at what seems to us an absolute passivity or immobility of our consciousness in which we cease from all mental and physical activity. There seem then to be an active consciousness in which consciousness works as an energy, throwing up knowledge and activity out of itself, and of which, therefore, tapas is the character, and a passive consciousness in which consciousness does not act as an energy, but only exists as a status, and of which, therefore, absence of tapas or force in action is the character. Is the apparent absence of tapas in this state real, or is there such an effective distinction in Satchitananda? It is affirmed that there is the dual status of Brahman, quiescent and creative, is indeed one of the most important and fruitful distinctions in Indian philosophy. It is, besides, a fact of spiritual experience. So, in other words, the absence of tapas is not real. Tapas is there even in what seems to be a passive consciousness. And its presence in both active and passive states, both quiescent and creative, allows us to reach this conclusion that Brahman is capable of a dual state. It can be active, it can be passive, but always it is one. So when Sri Aurobindo had his realization in 1908 of Nirvana, and then a year or so later his realization of the universal Brahman, the personal divinity dwelling in all things individually and cosmically, they were both the same reality. And he could merge these two great realizations in a single realization. It's like the unified field theory, except the unified spiritual theory. So let's go on. Here, let us observe first that by this passivity in ourselves, we arrive from particular and broken knowledge at a greater, a one, and a unifying knowledge. Secondly, that if, in the state of passivity, we open ourselves entirely to what is beyond, we can become aware of a power acting upon us which we feel to be not our own in the limited egoistic sense, but universal or transcendental, and that this power works through us for a greater play of knowledge, a greater play of energy, action, and result, which also we feel to be not our own, but that of the divine, of Satchit-Ananda, ourselves, only its field or channel. So here we've left the apparent divisions of the personal and the natural, and we have arrived at the divine. The result happens in both cases because our individual consciousness rests from an ignorant, limited action and opens itself to the supreme status or to the supreme action. So the individual can rest, that is to say, withdraws in the passive mode and becomes aware of the spiritual essence of all things behind, not addressing or dealing with the external, the dynamic. And then the other, opening itself to the supreme status. And so that means opening the consciousness deliberately, widely, growing in awareness so that a supreme status can invade the being and a supreme action result from that conscious invasion. So here, again, we interface yoga and philosophy. This is where theory and practice meet. And they meet brilliantly in the person of Sri Aurobindo and what he achieved. In the latter, he says, the more dynamic opening, there is power and play of knowledge and action, and that is tapas. But in the former also, in the static consciousness, there is evidently a power for knowledge and a concentration of knowledge, or at least a concentration of consciousness in immobility and a self-realization, and that too is tapas. Therefore, it would seem that tapas, concentration of power of consciousness, is the character of both the passive and the active consciousness of Brahman, and that our own passivity also has a certain character of an unseen supporting or instrumentalizing tapas. It is a concentration of energy of consciousness that sustains, while it lasts, all creation, all action, and kinesis. But it is also a concentration of power of consciousness that supports inwardly or informs all status, even the most immobile passivity, even an infinite stillness or an eternal silence. So whether we're talking about the energizing of a consciousness which becomes cosmic in its extent, or we're talking about holding that consciousness entirely within, in the passive reserve of the blanked Atman awareness, where nothing moves at all, it is the same tapas, at rest and at play. But still, it may be said, these are, in the end, two different things, and this is shown by their difference of opposite results. For a resort to the passivity of Brahman leads to the cessation of this existence, and a resort to the active Brahman leads to its continuance. But here, too, let us observe that this distinction arises by a movement of the individual soul from one poise to another, from the poise of Brahman consciousness in the world, where it is a fulcrum for the universal action, to or towards the poise of Brahman consciousness beyond the world, where it is a power for the withholding of energy from the universal action. Moreover, if it is by energy of tapas that the dispensing of force of being in the world action is accomplished, it is equally by the energy of tapas that the drawing back of that force of being is accomplished. The passive consciousness of Brahman and its active consciousness are not two different, conflicting, and incompatible things. They are the same consciousness, the same energy, at one end in a state of self-reservation, at the other cast into a motion of self-giving and self-deploying, like the stillness of a reservoir and the coursing of the channels which flow from it. In fact, behind every activity, there is and must be a passive power of being from which it arises, by which it is supported, which even, we see in the end, governs it from behind and without being totally identified with it, in the sense at least of being itself all poured out into the action and indistinguishable from it. Such a self-exhausting identification is impossible, for no action, however vast, exhausts the original power from which it proceeds, leaving nothing behind it in reserve. When we get back into our own conscious being, when we stand back from our own action and see how it is done, we discover that it is our whole being which stands behind any particular act or sum of activities, passive in the rest of its integrality, active in its limited dispensation of energy. But that passivity is not an incapable inertia, it is a poise of self-reserved energy. A similar truth must apply still more completely to the conscious being of the infinite, whose power in silence of status, as in creation, must also be infinite. And the power of analogy here, which he employs, reminds us that the truths of the everlasting are here in time, that what is true of the transcendent and the universal is also true of the individual. So what you find in yourself that speaks to these fundamental issues of being is true also of the nature of the universe. And so you can see that when you concentrate upon a topic, an issue, an intended action, that some of you concentrates on that. When you undertake the action, some part of you extends itself in energizing that. But the whole of you was supporting it. And just so it is with the divine. The divine energizes and establishes the cosmos, dwells within it. The cosmos, likewise, dwells within that being. But it is a tiny point of its action, and in no way could the cosmic activity, at whatever white heat it works, could exhaust all that is in the infinite. It is an expression of its totality, not the totality itself. So we proceed. It is immaterial for the moment to inquire whether the passivity out of which all emerges is absolute or only relative to the observable action from which it holds back. It is enough to note that, though we make the distinction for the convenience of our minds, there is not a passive Brahman and an active Brahman, but one Brahman, an existence which reserves its tapas in what we call passivity and gives itself in what we call its activity. For the purposes of action, these are two poles of one being, or a double power necessary for creation. The action proceeds on its circuit from the reservation and returns to it, presumably, the energies that were derived, to be again thrown out in a fresh circuit. The passivity of Brahman is tapas, or concentration of its being dwelling upon itself in a self-absorbed concentration of its immobile energy. The activity is tapas of its being releasing what it held out of that incubation into mobility and traveling in a million waves of action, dwelling still upon each as it travels and liberating in it the being's truths and potentialities. There, too, is a concentration of force, but a multiple concentration, which seems to us a diffusion. But it is not really a diffusion, but a deploying. Brahman does not cast its energy out of itself to be lost in some unreal exterior void, but keeps it at work within its being, conserving it unabridged and undiminished in all its continual process of conversion and transmutation. The passivity is a great conservation of Shakti, of tapas supporting a manifold initiation of movement and transmutation into forms and happenings. The activity is a conservation of Shakti, of tapas in the movement and transmutation. As in ourselves, so in Brahman, both are relative to each other. Both simultaneously coexist, pole and pole, in the action of one existence. While we could press on, I think this is a good place to pause in the total argument that he presents in this chapter. So we'll save the rest for our next session, when I think we will finish with this chapter on the origin of the ignorance. So, let us turn to Savitri now. This time, reading from Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, the Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Life. On every plane, this greatness must create. On earth, in heaven, in hell, she is the same. Of every fate, she takes her mighty part. A guardian of the fire that lights the suns, she triumphs in her glory and her might. Opposed, oppressed, she bears God's urge to be born. The spirit survives upon non-being's ground. World force outlasts world disillusion's shock. Dumb, she is still the word, inert, the power. Here fallen, a slave of death and ignorance, to things deathless she is driven to aspire and moved to know even the unknowable. Even nescient, null, her sleep creates a world. When most unseen, most mightily she works. housed in the atom, buried in the clod, her quick creative passion cannot seize. Inconscience is her long, gigantic pause. Her cosmic swoon is a stupendous phase. Time-born, she hides her immortality. In death, her bed, she waits the hour to rise. Even with the light denied that sent her forth, and the hope dead she needed for her task, even when her brightest stars are quenched in night, nourished by hardship and calamity, and with pain for her body's handmaid, masseuse, nurse, her tortured, invisible spirit continues still to toil, though in darkness, to create, though with pangs. She carries crucified God upon her breast. In chill, insentient depths, where joy is none, immured, oppressed by the resisting void, where nothing moves and nothing can become, still she remembers, still invokes the skill the wonder worker gave her at her birth, imparts to drowsy formlessness a shape, reveals a world where nothing was before. In realms confined to a prone circle of death, to a dark eternity of ignorance, a quiver in an inert, inconscient mass, or imprisoned in immobilized whirls of force, by matter's blind compulsion, deaf and mute, she refuses, motionless, in the dust to sleep. Then, for her rebel waking's punishment, given only hard mechanic circumstance as the enginery of her magic craft, she fashions godlike marvels out of mud. In the plasm, she sets her dumb immortal urge, helps the live tissue to think, the closed sense to feel, flashes through the frail nerves poignant messages in a heart of flesh miraculously loves. To brute bodies gives a soul, a will, a voice. Ever she summons, as by a sorcerer's wand, beings and shapes and scenes innumerable, torch-bearers of her pomps through time and space. This world is her long journey through the night, the suns and planets, lamps to light her road. Our reason is the confidant of her thoughts. Our senses are her vibrant witnesses. There, drawing her signs from things half true, half false, she labors to replace by realized dreams the memory of her lost eternity. There was an occasion earlier this week where much of the world order seemed to be thrown into discord. And as I watched events unfold, it seemed almost as if an enormous world snake was swallowing this golden egg, this earth on which we dwell. And it reminded me of a passage in Savitri. What can this darkness do if it swallows this golden egg? That egg is inside it. Here's a set of lines that I was reminded of. This is from the Book of Beginnings, The Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness, Book 1, Canto 5. The immobiles, ocean silence, saw him pass, an arrow leaping through eternity, suddenly shot from the tense bow of time, a ray returning to its parent sun. Opponent of that glory of escape, the black inconscient swung its dragon tail, lashing a slumbrous infinite by its force into the deep obscurities of form. Death lay beneath him like a gate of sleep. One pointed to the immaculate delight, questing for God as for a splendid prey, he mounted, burning like a cone of fire. To a few is given that godlike rare release. One among many thousands, never touched, engrossed in the external world's design, is chosen by a secret witness eye and driven by a pointing hand of light across his soul's unmapped immensitudes. Remember who you are. You are here on that quest. You are that brilliant arrow leaping into the beyond. Shake off that darkness. Be your luminous soul. The world needs you more than ever now. Until next week. Namaste. Jai Ma.